Land Podcast with David Amoyama.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcio Land podcast. So today we actually have a talk about some games. We had a Coppa Italia action over the weekend, so we'll do some winners and losers, which we haven't done in a while. We have some great Twitter questions from our listeners. And as I promised last week, we were going to celebrate the 20th anniversary of The Sopranos this week on Calcioland. So today, to kick it off, we have a couple of questions on Sopranos that I'm going to answer. But the second part of the podcast is an interview I did with Dan Greca, who does sports radio here in the United States on ESPN Radio, as well as SiriusXM. He's a huge Sopranos fan like me, so we got pretty deep into the show. And then we also talked about his career a little bit, because a lot of you guys are podcasters and whatnot, and I think he has a lot of cool stuff to share with us. So I think you'll enjoy that interview, and that's in the second part of the podcast. But before we get to that, I am joined by our great friend, the producer, co-host, Alex Goldberg. And the topic I want to kick it off is Higuain. This has become a full drama in the January transfer window. If you are a transfer news nerd and someone who really likes to get in deep into details of the deals, I actually can't think of one that's as complex and exciting if you're someone like me. But Alex, I just want to ask you really simply, and this is something that, you know, I saw a lot of tweets about this and it made me think. So I wanted to ask you of this situation with Higuain there. You know, him wanting to leave, I want to ask you, does this ultimately say more about him or more about Milan? And the reason I say it is, you know, we know Higuain's very emotional, someone who, you know, you can read his emotion. Do you think he's kind of almost like quitting on the team? Or the flip side, do you think, you know, kind of Bonucci wanted to leave almost right away? What does that say about Milan that the really top tier players, you know, guys that were good enough to start for Juve, would want to leave? So I want to ask you, of those two things, which do you think stands out more to you?
It's a really good question, David. And I'm kind of having a battle in my head still to this point about answering this. Now, my gut is it says a little bit more about Milan because, as you said, Bonucci's there for a year and then boom, he's out. And Higuain's here and already he wants out and clearly does want out. All these things on Twitter popping up, videos of him unhappy, stories of him unhappy. It's very clear he does want out. So on a whole, yeah, arguably Milan's two biggest players in the last 2 years, not in their history, but just their two biggest names. Bonucci was really their biggest name last year, just in terms of what he's accomplished and the magnitude of the player in the league. And then Gonzalo Higuain, he's the biggest name on AC Milan right now. He really is. So when your two biggest names both have quick exits, and I'm assuming Higuain will have a quick exit, but either way, he wants to have a quick exit, you got to think, that's not the Milan of the past. The Milan of the past had just such an aura to it that once you were there, you didn't want to leave on a whole. Maybe some players did, but overall, it wasn't a club that you just went and said, eh, never mind, bye-bye. But David, I'm going to counter what I just said by saying, well, Bonucci and Higuain are not just any players. They also have attachments to prior Serie A clubs, of course. Bonucci wasn't just a player from anywhere that went to Milan and then decided, no, thank you. He was a Juventus player. So it's really not fully fair to pin that all on Milan and how they made him feel. And then also with Higuain, Napoli and Juventus were his teams before Milan. So it's very skewed on that hand. But I am going to lean towards Milan because if I'm going to say it says more about Higuain, my counter to that would be this happens with strikers. Striker is that position where really, if it's not working out, you don't stay too long. I think that's the number one position in football, that if a player just is not having it at that club, you move on. They may be able to score goals, but striker is such a specific position of confidence and comfortability that if it isn't the situation for you, you still might be a world-class player. You still might be a good player, but you move on. And I'm not sure it really says a lot about you. Higuain has proved himself in Serie A plenty. And I just think now with Sarri at Chelsea, and the big thing here is with Milan really trying to build a foundation and move forward, David, Higuain's not dumb. He knows that he's not part of their future. So I really don't think it says a lot about him. If he were 25 years old and he had just left Juventus and now was leaving Milan, I would say, whoa, what's going on here with Higuain? Why can he not stay at any place? But he's no dummy. He knows that Milan have a future beyond him. So I just think with Sarri at Chelsea and Chelsea needing a striker and everything, it doesn't say a whole lot about Higuain. I think it's pretty common for strikers that if it's just not working out, you move on pretty quickly. So this was not easy for me to answer, but if I have to pick one, I do think it says a little bit more about Milan and where they're at and still how far they have to go. So that's my answer, David. What about you?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. And this really came to my mind. Someone that I follow on Twitter, a Milan fan based in Napoli, Corrado. I think a lot of our listeners know him. To me, he's one of the best guys in all of Milan Twitter. Really knows the club's history, and I think he's really objective. He's not just a cheerleader. If something has to be said, he said it. And he tweeted that, you know, it really says a lot about Milan that so many strikers have failed this there. I actually thought Higuain was going to end the curse of the number nine at Milan after Ibrahimovic left. Like, just a plethora of guys that struggled in that role. And Higuain seems to be one more of that. And then, of course, we have the Bonucci and the Higuain situations. And look, they are a little bit different. You know, both of them wanted to stay in Italy, and realistically, Milan was the only game in town. You know, Bonucci could go back because Juve hadn't acquired Ronaldo in his role, so they are a little bit different. But bottom line, it does say a lot to me about the situation at Milan. I remember one of our favorite listeners who sends us questions, Prisoner of the Moment, asked us, you know, does Inter have to hire an exorcist? And my answer was like, you know what? I think Milan needs it a little bit more because look, they've changed ownership, they've changed managers, they've changed sporting directors, and it just feels like we're always stuck in the same situation. And another person that I follow on Twitter, Guillaume in France, who helps out on Di Marzio side with the news in French and is a big Milan fan, he made a really good point a while ago. Milan has tried everything else. Now they have to bring in a great manager. And I completely agree with him. That to me is something they need to do. Maybe this is why a lot of this is happening. But bottom line, something's got to change. As far as, you know, and I know in a second we're going to get into what's going on with the latest on the transfer rumors. I saw today my friend Fabrizio Romano had a really good article on Higuain, and he said the reason everything changed for Higuain and why all of a sudden he's been pushing to leave is Milan changed their stance on the option to buy. Because I remember in the summer when the negotiation started, Higuain didn't want to go out on loan. He wanted a permanent sale. But Milan told them, hey, we're spending $18 million for the loan. The only reason we're not making it a forced option to buy or just buying you outright is financial fair play. So this is like we're buying you. And then we remember Leonardo a few weeks ago saying both Higuain and Bakayoko staying are dependent on us making the Champions League. So it was public, I think, in a way that was almost embarrassing to Higuain. So I'm not going to justify the way he's been acting because, look, he's one of the highest paid players in the league. He has to do better. But I can see maybe a little bit where this is coming. So that's another reason why I think maybe this says a little bit more about Milan.
Yeah, it really is turning into a soap opera. And Chelsea fans don't need this soap opera because they obviously had one with Maurizio Sarri not too long ago. So at this point, I so am attracted to Serie A players and managers, but man, it's like going through a colonoscopy just to get one. So, David, you alluded to it. What is the latest on Gonzalo Higuain?
Yeah, so I wrote an article on this with our friends at Euro Fantasy Gamers. Look, I'm someone who always says on this podcast, I really don't care what is said publicly about transfers. It's not that important, but the quotes from Milan, and, you know, I mentioned already one by Leonardo, are really stunning. I don't think I've ever quite seen something quite like this because usually quotes on transfer rumors are about maintaining the status quo, like players, agents, coaches saying, oh, he's staying. nobody's moving, blah, blah, blah. And people then take it as a blanket statement. Okay, the transfer rumors are BS when, you know, stuff could be going on. So usually when you're talking about your own player, it's very rare that you open up the door to potentially leaving. So then we had Gattuso after the match against Sampdoria saying, hey, you know, when a player makes up his mind, there's very little you can do. I'm going to try to keep him. And also, it's really public. Higuain wants to go. I think Chelsea's really attractive for him because of Sarri. He had already said he wanted to play in the Premier League. But, you know, just because a player wants to go, there's other people. And in this transaction, as I alluded to, it's much more complicated than a standard transfer. Because for one, Milan invested $18 million on the loan to acquire him. So they're going to want some sort of compensation. For that, they need to find a replacement, which isn't easy in January. And the latest name that they're listed to is Piontek, because it seems like Morata, Milan isn't too crazy on him. And it's more likely that Morata will be going back to Spain. So there's those factors. So that's just on the Milan side. On the Chelsea fan, just because Higuain wants to go doesn't mean that he will go. You know better than me, Alex. Chelsea is very reticent to invest heavily on players over 30. So there's that. And then the other variable, and this is Juve. And we've talked a lot about it on the podcast. I think despite the fact that Milan plays in their league, I think Juve would have wanted nothing more than Higuain to even lead Serie A in scoring, had an unbelievable season. So Higuain would definitely stay at Milan. So I think if they break the loan, they're going to want some sort of guarantee that whoever takes Higuain is going to keep him next season, because his value would just keep going down. So I said it from the first day the rumor emerged that in my mind, if this deal happens, I would be very surprised if it's not a multi-year loan deal, kind of like what we saw Cuadrado to Juve the second time, not the first time he went, because he briefly went back to Chelsea, where they're basically protecting the amortized value and just stretching out the deal for as long as possible. So again, the big development is it's out in the open. Higuain wants to go, but that in and of itself isn't enough. So I have a feeling we'll be talking quite a bit about this one on our second episode of the week.
Yeah, Chelsea's policy with players over 30 is on a whole a good one, but it's too cut and dry. It's so black and white. If you're over 30, you just can't get a multi-year deal. And David, Chelsea are really in trouble because they don't have a director of football. So this is why it is such a problem when trying to negotiate and getting players over 30. So yes, we are not back to Serie A football, but we do have a Monday edition of Winners and Losers because there was some Coppa Italia. So David, without further ado, who are winners and losers of episode 186 of the Calciolan podcast?
Yeah, I'm excited that this is back. And I'm also excited to report that Milinkovic-Savic had another really good game. And granted, it was against Novara, but had another goal. He's really starting to look like the player that I fell in love with. So anyone out there who wants to sell their Milinkovic-Savic stock, you want to call him a one-season wonder, which is already inaccurate because he was good the season before he exploded last year. But if you're in that camp and you want to sell that stock pretty cheap, I'm ready. I'm buying it all. I'm all in on him the rest of the season. Luis Alberto also had a good game for Lazio. Then we had the Milan match against Sampdoria. So we had Peperina, who actually played like the highest paid backup goalkeeper. And Serie A had a really excellent performance. I'm critical of him in general, but he deserves a lot of respect there. And I think the fact that he had a really good game is also kudos to Sampdoria as well. I thought Paqueta, who made his debut, was quite good. You know, not amazing, but again, it was his first match, barely practiced with the team. He looks like he can bring a little bit of pace and speed, something that Milan was lacking. We had Patrick Cutrone with two goals. And that's another thing. Maybe Milan start saying, hey, you know, maybe Cutrone can be the main guy that replaces Higuain. A few weeks ago, Quagliarella was linked to Sampdoria, and then he signed an extension. But maybe in retrospect, a player like Quagliarella with Cutrone playing more wouldn't have been the worst way to replace Higuain. I think the question is, do you see Patrick Cutrone as just a great super sub or someone that can actually start? I'm seeing people comparing him to Icardi because they have similar goal-scoring averages. That might be a little bit far-fetched, but obviously the guy does score when it matters. And I like to joke around that Cutrone must be Italian for makes things happen because his game isn't just scoring goals. And also shout out to Conti, Milan's right wing back. He's been struggling with a lot of injuries, came in the game and had a really beautiful assist on Cutrone. Then we had Juve's win against Bologna. It was a good match for Juve because they were able to play a lot of bench players that normally don't play. Moise Kean had another goal. He had scored previously in Bologna. I think it was his first goal as a professional. He had to deal, unfortunately, with some racist chanting, which we'll get to later on. But Moise Kean, really a talented player. We had Bernardeschi, who had gotten off to a gangbuster start to the season, then struggled. He scored as well. And Spinazzola, his first start for Juve. I thought he looked really quite good there. So I think, you know, Juve with Spinazzola has to decide. Does it make sense to have him go to another team on loan so he can just play the rest of the season? And I would probably lean towards that. Or do we just keep him as a super sub to back up Alexandro? So good game all around for Juve. So I got to be honest, on Sunday, I had to take a little break from Calcio. I know there's been the international break, but I've been knee deep in transfers. So I didn't watch the games live. I did watch some highlights. And, you know, I'm going to talk more of what I read in the paper and some of the highlights. But, you know, I like to always be very transparent with our listeners. So we had Inter's big win with a lot of bench players shining. Dalbert, who's been their backup left back, had a good performance. Spalletti finally played Lautaro Martinez and Icardi together. Although after the match, he once again said that Lautaro Martinez doesn't track back and he's strictly a striker. To me, that was kind of him saying, don't get used to this. And then we had Candreva with a brace. And then we had my boy, Arkadiusz Milik, started off the new year, kind of how he finished the previous one, scored again. Then we had the debut of one of Napoli's most exciting Primavera player. And Napoli really isn't known for their youth system. But this player, Gianluca Gaetano, who some of our listeners have been asking me about, I had never seen him made his debut. And I did see that one of the best agents in the business, Federico Pastorello, I think he's his agent now. So that's a big win for Gaetano because, to me, Pastorello is as good as it gets because he's not flashy like Mino Raiola and maybe Wanda, but he gets a lot of stuff done. So kudos to Federico Pastorello. Kudos to Gaetano. Pastorello also has Alex Meret, the up-and-coming keeper for Napoli. And then we had Chiesa, who had a really up-and-down first part of the season, started off really strong, then struggled like the rest of Fiorentina, had a great brace against Torino. And then I'm going to put one that's not Serie A related, but a player you and I, Alex, have talked a lot about and have defended a lot on this podcast. And I'm so not surprised Paul Pogba is back to being Paul Pogba and doing Paul Pogba things. I'm not the biggest Mourinho guy, so, you know, I picked my side there. I've been wrong plenty of times. It was nice seeing people tweet me about Pogba, but hey, you know, I'm wrong a lot of times. I'm just happy for him. And again, I'm so not surprised that we're seeing this from him. The flip side for the losers, I talked about Piperina being the best the highest paid backup keeper and playing like it in the Coppa Italia. Same cannot be said for some of the other ones. And Sampdoria's keeper, Rafael, had a blunder on the goal. Bologna's keeper, Da Costa, really struggled. And because he didn't play, I'm still going to put as a loser, Pirin, because that would have been a match where Juve should have absolutely played him. But to me, it sounds like maybe Juve has a little bit of doubts on this. They spun it as Szczesny started to keep him sharp for the Super Cup match. But I don't know. I got to be honest. I like Pirin, and I think he's good. I never thought he was the second coming of Buffon, despite him playing for my Padova. I wouldn't be shocked if Pirin ends up like Neto, who then says, you know what, maybe I don't want to be a backup at Juve after all. So I hope he proves me wrong. Again, nice guy, battled a lot of injuries, plays for Padova, but I have some concerns there. And then two players on Napoli, losers. Diarra, who I think this season has taken a pretty big step back. Ancelotti's given him more opportunities. He has yet to really make a big impact. Napoli's asking a lot for him. He kind of strikes me as someone that maybe could use a change of scenery. And another player that really struggled is Hizaj. Really didn't do well in the match against Sassuolo. I watched just the highlights, but I read in the press he didn't do well. Look, and it wasn't long ago that Hizaj was in the conversation for best right back in Serie A. It's really amazing how things change. And then we had Belotti, who continues to struggle a little bit. I know some Roma fans have been getting excited about him potentially coming there. I got to say, I'm not that impressed. One of the reasons I think Torino should be doing better this season, because they really equipped the team well, is that Belotti just hasn't gone back to his glory days. He has 7 goals in Serie A, 4 of them are off a penalty, didn't have a good match in the Coppa Italia. So I know we talked a little bit about Piontek potentially going to Milan. I saw some other sites linking him to Real Madrid. That seems a bit far-fetched. But if I'm Genoa, I'm selling Piontek as fast as I can, because there could be some Belotti syndrome there. So one thing that's not a syndrome, something that's always excellent, are the Twitter questions from our listeners. So as always, you can send us Twitter questions on calcio, transfers, pop culture. I've been getting a lot of really good ones on pop culture, but because we are going deep on Sopranos this week, I'm going to save them for another day. They aren't that time sensitive. So if you sent a question on that, you know, I love questions on music and films. We're going to save them for a later date. But which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with this. What do you think would be the best long-term solution for the racist chants in the stadiums?
So I was talking not long ago that Serie A could really use some positive momentum, because I thought 2018 was a banner year. And then we had the VAR issues, the Koulibaly racist chants. And I got to say, we're not off to a good start of the year. The Super Cup in Saudi Arabia, that had been planned before. What are you going to do? But this week in Serie A, this weekend in the Coppa Italia matches, we had quite a few episodes. It was so bad that I saw Gazzetta dello Sport actually praised the fans of Sampdoria for not making racist chants. And look, God bless them, that's better than others. But if now we're at the point that we have to praise fan bases for not doing this, we really are in trouble. So there were some chants against Jews with the Lazio match. We had the Keane racist chants at Bologna. And I have to say, that really surprised me, because most ultra groups and whatnot tend to be right-wing groups. Bologna is one of the rare exceptions. They're more left-wing. Bologna is one of the most left-wing leaning cities in Italy. So that was even more disappointing. And I go back to it, like, to me, it's all about personal responsibility. I saw Marotta saying it's not fair to Inter fans that we shut down the stadium. 95% of our fans are great. And I completely agree with it. To me, it's all about really eliminating the bad apples. In calcio, they're very serious about the violence, getting people out. And I think they need to do the same. I go back to the fact they need to do what they're doing in the Premier League. I saw there was somewhat an incident during, I think, the Spurs game, Manchester City. It was reported in the paper that they're going to try to find the person responsible and just get it done with. To me, that's the solution. There's just too much, you know, some of these fans, ultras, been going to the game for a long time. There's connections with the club, like, enough's enough. And the other thing I'm going to say, I had to unfollow some people on Twitter, even some that I've been following for a while, because I'm so done with the whataboutism on racial stuff. If you don't know what whataboutism is, it's like basically instead of taking responsibility, you just say, well, other people do this, and start comparing it to other things. It's like, enough already. This isn't an Inter thing. I said it very clearly, the Koulibaly thing. Inter was punished probably because it was such a, you know, it was such a big stage and it happened a lot in that match, maybe more than in other things. But it's like, enough. Every fan base just has to take responsibility, and that's it. I really hate this thing comparing, well, our fan base, not as bad as that one. Why aren't they punishing this? It's like, enough. Like, no whataboutism, personal responsibility. Let's get the people responsible out. I'm a firm believer that's the only thing that's going to work, because I'm just not really, I just don't think you can legislate good manners and common sense, but you can hold the people responsible, accountable, and get them out of the stadiums.
All right, David, next Twitter question comes from Juan Sebastian, and he asks, I've been following Serie A for 20 years. Has there always been so much controversy on referees, or did Calciopoli make it much worse?
Yes, I definitely think Calciopoli has made things worse. I've noticed that if I tweet a poll on our Calcioland account, because I like to kind of gauge where people are going, If it involves Juve and Inter having anything to do with the two clubs, it really escalates a lot more. But regardless of that, I definitely think it's gotten worse with Calciopoli. But this started way before Calciopoli. And this is going to be my first ties to The Sopranos. And I think it was the first episode of the fifth season. Carmella and AJ Jr. are talking about the system of raccomandazioni in Italy, which is really the idea that to get a good job, it's all about knowing someone and paying bribes and whatnot. So in Italy, there always is this perception that things aren't above the board, that there's always some kind of conspiracy. And I think, and for the most part, there's good reason for this. So, you know, just know that in Italy, this is something really central to the culture. But referee controversies have been a big part of Italian football ever since I've been following it. And, you know, I was born in 77, but, you know, even in the early 80s before I followed, there was a very controversial Scudetto that Juve won over Fiorentina. There was a really a controversial referee decision that Fiorentina feels it cost them the Scudetto, and that really created a bigger rivalry between the two clubs. Then we had the Ronaldo-Giuliano incident in the late 90s with Juve and Inter, which people still talk about consistently. Gazzetta dello Sport can still put it on the front page and it will still sell. So yeah, Calciopoli made it worse, but this has been going on for a very long time.
All right, David, how about this? Robbie Zimmer asks us, with Fabio Paratici flat out blocking Bonazzi's exit in January, has Juve found their wartime consigliere?
Great question, Robbie. This was one of my favorite takes that I had on the podcast a while ago. I think it was about a year ago. And I said that, you know what? I really love Marotta. I'm a huge fan. But even beyond him, and this has been Juve's policy even more than Marotta. This goes back to the Avvocato Agnelli. That Juve's policy was like, if a player wants to leave, we are Juve. We are bigger than a player. We can replace him. If a player wants to go, he just goes. So I think, you know, Marotta was definitely part of that. But I think this was a bigger than Marotta because, again, it precedes him there. Juve has always felt they are above the club. But I think everything changed this summer. I think the Ronaldo signing, we just have a much more ruthless Juve saying, you know what, we need to be a little bit more like Bayern or PSG, you know, teams that dominate their league, but we have to win the Champions League and be a little bit ruthless. And it's just what not with Benatti. I mean, Juve doesn't want to get rid of Moise Kean. They like to keep Spinazzola. They're just like, we're keeping everyone because we're going all in for the Champions League. So yeah, I'm not sure if this is really so much a Paratici or more of an Andrea Agnelli change in policy, but this is definitely something changing. So shout out to Robbie. Great question.
Indeed, definitely. All right, how about this? Daryl Saliba asks, we know that there's a large amount of pressure at Roma. Should they aim to win the Coppa Italia to try and alleviate some of it?
Very good question. I like it. Roma actually could really use a trophy. I think they're known way more for being a supermarket, for selling players and whatnot. It would be nice to finally get one in the books. And I actually think it's a good idea, especially now, because I think Di Francesco in the Champions League got him out of the group this year. We know of the great run last year has shown that he actually has quite a knack for these tournaments with this format. So I like this idea. I think Roma should go all in to try to win the Coppa Italia this season. This makes a lot of sense to me. I think everything lines up quite well for it.
All right. Another Twitter question from somebody we have the name of, and I'm doing okay so far pronouncing them. Cody Bateson asks, should Inter consider using a 3-5-2 when Godin arrives so they can start both Icardi and Lautaro Martinez?
So first of all, I hope Cody is right, because this would mean Skriniar's definitely staying. I really hope so. And I really hope it's like our friend Gab Romano on Friday said that Godin's coming to replace Miranda. I really hope that's the case. So yesterday, Spalletti said no club can afford Skriniar because he's not on the market. So I hope that's absolutely true. So let's say that that's the case. I think, you know, formations is about putting as many as your best players on the team as possible. I'm going to die on the hill that Godin, Skriniar, and De Vrij as a trio are very comparable to the BBC. I'm not going to bore you saying why, but I definitely think that this would be a defense comparable to that and a defense comparable to the one Inter had when they won the treble. Now, my only reservation is, yeah, that would allow Icardi and Lautaro Martinez to play together. But more than that, I think Inter's really short in the midfield. to play this formation. You know, it's kind of crazy to say that Brozovic is the only one that you definitely would say should be a starter next season. So this is really a position that I think Inter has to bolster, especially if they want to use this type of formation.
All right, David, next Twitter question. When a player is on loan with option to buy, does that option only apply to the purchasing team, or can the selling team recall the player?
If I had to guess, this question has to do with Andres Silva. I could be wrong. If I am, my apologies to the person that sent it. And look, every loan, most loans are the same. Like, the option to buy is for the club that takes the player on loan. But there are exceptions. There are complicated loan deals. Like, as an example, Juve and Inter have done a lot of these loan deals that are co-ownerships in disguise, where they loan a player. The club that has him on loan has an option to buy him at a certain price, but Juve or Inter have a higher price where they can bring the player back. So basically, they are locking in the cost of what it would cost to bring back the player. If the other club develops the player on loan, they benefit financially doing it that way. So it really depends on the terms of the deal. In general, as a rule of thumb, I would say that it's all about the club that has the option to buy, but there are exceptions. Andres Silva isn't one of them. It's completely up to his Spanish club what they want to do with him. So I have a question for you, Alex. This came in from one of our listeners, and he wants to know, Alex, if you were starting a new club and could only take as a winger one between these two players, Perisic or your favorite, Willian, who I think maybe... after Marcos Alonso is your least favorite player on Chelsea, who would it be and why?
Oh, boy. Oh, man. That is really twisting my arm. Now, of course, I have closer feelings to Willian, and I really say that not probably how it sounds. I, as you said, am not a huge fan of Willian, but my bias is against Willian way more so than Perisic. But I do know how Inter fans feel about Ivan Perisic at this point. And when you look at their statistics on the season, they're almost comparable. Willian has 3 goals and 3 assists, and Ivan Perisic has 3 goals and 2 assists. Oh, man, I would have to take Perisic, David, and I'm not saying it because I'm just so frustrated with Willian. Willian's 1 year older, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure that Perisic is the perfect professional, but when Willian put the emojis over Antonio Conte, and I know some people may be like, well, what a hypocrite you are. You wanted Conte out. But that's for a whole different reason, and I'm a fan. Willian was a professional. He put emojis all over Antonio Conte after they won the FA Cup. I am so down on Willian as a player and a professional. I have to just by default take Ivan Perisic. But that was not easy, and it was a great question. All right, David, next Twitter question. What would be your solution to Chelsea's striker issues in both the long term and the short term?
Yeah, I'm going to get your thoughts on this. And I have a feeling this is a Chelsea fan saying, hey, maybe we can get Higuain on loan and then worry in the summer for a bigger, for a younger name or someone to have long term. So I could see that. Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking, you know, a striker that hasn't been linked to Chelsea that I think would fit really well for them is Cavani at PSG. He's not the youngest guy, but I think, you know, he's one of the best central strikers in the world. I'd be intrigued to see how he does with Sarri. As far as, like, the younger players, like, you know, they've been linked to Piontek. Yeah, you guys heard my thoughts earlier on him. I'm still not convinced by him. So maybe someone like that to look at would be my guess. And while we're on the subject on Piontek, as we're recording this, I saw Di Marzio tweeted that Milan had the first contacts with Genoa to acquire him. So interesting story there. Genoa, though, doesn't want to sell him now. They would need a very big offer. And we know of Milan's issues with financial fair play. So let's see what happens there. But the one I would really look at is Cavani. So I want to get your thoughts on this, Alex. You're knee deep on Chelsea. In an ideal world, you know, who would you like to do? I'm going to say Icardi's off the table for any club. But, you know, you can mention him if you think he's an ideal player for them.
Sure. So for the short term, Cavani, I definitely like Cavani for the short term. Chelsea just need a player who knows how to score goals and who has a striker's mentality. Cavani definitely has a striker's mentality, at least more so than Alvaro Morata. My big thing, David, is mentality. Whoever Chelsea are bringing in next have to have a different mentality than Morata. They can't be soft. they have to have that mentality where the short memory, where if they miss, they don't let their previous shot affect the rest of their game. So I would say Cavani, that's a good shout on your part. Gonzalo Higuain, of course, I would take him for the short term, familiar with Sarri, and he also has a striker's mentality, at least once again, more so than Morata. And this one, Chelsea fans will really disagree with me on, but I wouldn't hate having Karim Benzema for a year, just a year. Now, long term, much different. You said I couldn't say Icardi, but I'll try and say Icardi. I would say Icardi, Timo Werner over in the Bundesliga. And then, in my opinion, my best shout here is Maxi Gomez for Celta Vigo in La Liga, really having a phenomenal season, really becoming a very good forward, 9 goals, 5 assists this year, the Uruguayan, and he really has that mentality, that tenacity that I am looking for in a striker, and I actually think he'd be a good fit with Maurizio Sarri, but I won't spiel about it because there's been literally no rumors about it, but those are my answers. So, David, let's move away from football now. What are some of your favorite Sopranos episodes?
All right, listeners, get yourself a gun. We are going to start going deep on Sopranos. So here it starts. We're going to have 1,000 names on later this week because he has a lot of thoughts on this. So I'm going to kick it off by saying what are my favorite Sopranos episodes. I think in general, the two most famous episodes are the Pine Barrens one, which is the one with the Russian in the woods who disappears. And, you know, him and Paulie and Christopher chase him in the woods. It's never resolved, which I think is really cool because kind of the last episode wasn't completely resolved either, although I have a pretty strong theory, which I'll save for later this week. And by the way, that episode was directed by Steve Buscemi. I would say that's often linked as the best one. The other one is the Whitecaps one, and that's the one where Tony and Carmella split up. One of the most powerful acting I think I've ever seen, not just TV. I mean, that just really transcends TV. Kind of, it's as almost on the level of Pacino and Godfather 2 when he finds out that Kay had an abortion. It's that good. So those are the most popular ones as far as the best ones. But I'm going to give you some different ones. What was pretty typical about Sopranos and other series took this is it really wasn't the series finale where all the season finale where everything went down and there was the big cliffhanger and the big issues. Like Sopranos would typically do this in the next to last episode of the season. And the last episode would be just an opportunity to see how the big event, how people settled into it. So there were a couple that really stood out to me. The Blue Comet and the last season, probably my favorite episode, the one where Bobby Bacala dies, Silvio gets shot. There's just so much tension on that episode. I'll never forget the first time I watched it. And when I rewatch it now, I get that feeling again. Another one, Long-Term Parking, the one where Adriana gets killed. Spoiler alert, where Silvio kills her. Just a really emotionally wrecking episode. So those of are really, really stand out to me. These aren't next to last episodes in the season, but two of them that I really enjoyed. One of them, Stage 5, that's the one where Johnny Sack cancer really intensifies. But more than that, there's the Cleaver premiere. That's the horror movie that they were producing. That whole episode kills me. It's got a lot of tension, but also a lot of comedy. So that's one of my favorite. And another one, which was the first episode of the sixth season, which was the Soprano family movies. And this is the one where Janice, Bacala, Tony and Carmella, I think, go to Maine. That episode's really, really good when they play a board game and they start fighting. I mean, that one's really, really outstanding. So those are my favorite. I'm sure I'm forgetting some. I'd love to hear from our listeners, which are some of your favorite ones.
All right, David, last Twitter question, and boy, is this a big one. What is your favorite thing about The Sopranos?
Okay, so I'll tell you, authenticity and the fact that they were in on the joke. And what I mean by that, and I'll start with that, there are some parts where they are clearly paying tribute to movies that they enjoy, and they talk about it. They are very conscious of the fact that they love The Godfather. You know, they don't even call it Godfather 1 or 2. They just say in 1 and in 2. That's something I heard in Bill Simmons' podcast that was a really cool little touch. So they're really into that. And I think it's pretty obvious that they know that they're not quite like the mobsters in The Godfather. They're much more like the ones in Goodfellas. And what I like about that is kind of like in Goodfellas, they don't glamorize them too much. You really kind of see too what kind of dirtbags they can be too. So that's one thing that I really enjoy. Speaking of Goodfellas and being in on the joke, the actor that plays Christopher is Spider in Goodfellas, and Joe Pesci shoots him in one of the most famous scenes in Goodfellas, and they actually make a joke about that in Sopranos in a scene where Christopher goes to the bakery, and I forget if he ends up shooting someone, but they definitely pay homage to that. So that's one thing that I really enjoy about it, and also how authentic it is. You know, I grew up in Italy, but I also spent the mother's side of my family's on Long Island. I spent a lot of time there outside New York. There's a lot of like wise guys, kind of like The Sopranos. So, you know, not the really glamorous ones. And they really, really nailed them. I used to go to this restaurant where there used to be all the Gambino crew would go there all the time. And you really would feel like you're in an episode of The Sopranos. So I think they really nailed that really, really well. And then, yeah, we're going to get into it in the interview in a second. But to me, the use of the music in Sopranos, just incredible. I think David Chase is a genius when it comes to music. It's kind of like Scorsese and his movies started using music very well. But to me, there's a big difference. Scorsese plays a lot of the same songs, and he plays some really famous songs, like I think Gimme Shelter from the Stones is in multiple movies that he's done. But I think Chase can really find, you know, some songs that aren't that well known. I've gotten into a lot of songs I had never heard because of Sopranos. So we're kicking it off this way. Now I'm going to, before we get to the interview, we want to give a shout out to BioCBD Plus. This is a product we've been talking a lot about on the podcast. This comes in pills form, vaping pen, and especially the oil, which works really well if you have aches and pains. I'm a huge fan of this. This is a completely legal product. I know I've talked about this story. At my day job, I turned on someone on my team about this. He had shoulder issues. He was blown away. I can't tell you how many people came up to me, and they almost felt like it was shady. Like, oh, and I'm like, listen, this is a completely legal product. So if you're in pain or you deal with inflammation, this is really, really great stuff. So huge shout outs to our friends at BioCBD Plus. We're going to tweet the link to their account. We have a discount code CulturalLand15. I stand behind this product. If you order it, I think you'll really enjoy it. If you don't, contact me. Because I really believe in this so much. So I'm a huge fan of this. What about you, Alex? Anything else you want to add about this product?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that it's legal. And not only is it legal, but it also is free of all chemical fillers. It's really not bad for you at all. If anything, it's good for you. And I'll be honest, I need to start working out more. And I finally worked out a little bit this weekend. And boy, was I achy afterwards. And in the past, when I've been achy after working out, what has that transpired in? Well, me not working out because I'm achy. But now, no excuses, Alex. You have the topical oil from BioCBD Plus. You put it on wherever you're achy, and boom, wasn't achy anymore. And I got a workout in the following day. So, David, you're so spot on. The oil is awesome. The capsules are awesome. The vape pen is so awesome and so easy to use. We really, really recommend their products. BioCBDPlus.com is where you can find their products. And as David said, use our discount code CulturalLand15, all lowercase, CulturalLand15, to get 15% off their products. You'll love it.
Okay. And we're going to continue the Sopranos extravaganza. So the interview today, there's very little talk about football. There's really just one question. I had my good friend Dan Greca. You'll hear in the interview why I wanted to have him on the show. So if you love Sopranos, you love podcasting, journalism, want to learn more about that field, I think you'll really enjoy this interview. We're also going to do another episode later this week. So as usual, if you have a question, tweet us with the CulturalLand hashtag. We also really appreciate your support for the podcast. This is a completely free podcast. We've never asked you to fund it in any way. So we appreciate your support. If you dig what you hear, retweet us, you know, tell your friends that you like this podcast. If you could leave us a review on iTunes, I'd be eternally grateful because you wouldn't believe how much those help. So thanks for your support. Here's the interview, and we look forward to chatting with you on Friday again. Okay, so as I promised you guys, this week we are going to get into celebrating The Sopranos. It was the 20th anniversary of the first episode airing on HBO. They've had a big marathon on HBO. I found myself watching a ton of episodes despite having seen all of them at least 10 times. So I was thinking, you know, who could I bring on to help kick off the week of Sopranos? And I couldn't think of anyone better than my friend Dan Bracca. And I got to know Dan over the summer when he was covering the World Cup on Sirius XM. We have a friend in common, Mike Francesa's producer, Mons, and he asked me to appear on his show, and we did one and we hit it off, and he asked me back two other times. So for those of you that aren't familiar with Dan, he covers mainly, he covers U.S. sports. He does on SNY TV, he covers the Jets. He's on ESPN NY 98.7 FM, ESPN Radio, Sirius XM on Mad Dog Radio. Really great stuff. So what I like about Dan is he hustles a lot, does a lot of shows, and he's a big Sopranos expert. So Dan, it's a pleasure to have you now on my show. So welcome to Cultureland.
Dave, pleasure being here. It's nice to be able to return the favor, and thank you for the kind introduction. It's great. And hey, who better to be on to talk about The Sopranos than somebody who's a lifelong New Jersey native, right? Couldn't be better.
Absolutely. And actually, you are calling in from Jersey, which is great. So we're going to get into your career a little bit. We're going to talk about how soccer fits into the sports landscape in the U.S. because you cover mainly American sports. And I also want to get into your career. But let's get started with The Sopranos. So I know you're a big fan like me. So I'm going to ask you very simply, what in your opinion makes it such an influential TV show?
Well, to start off, I mean, when you were talking a little while ago about it being the 20th anniversary, I don't know about you, but do you have a hard time just comprehending the fact that it's been 20 years? I mean, where did 20 years go? I mean, it went by like in the snap of a finger. I guess it means we're just getting old. I don't know what it is, you know? So first and foremost, that's the thing that surprised me the most. What makes it, I mean, look, we could sit here and people have written books, you know, on about this subject alone. But I think that the first thing that probably jumps out is that, you know, it is very relatable. I think to most people, not to say that everybody is involved in organized crime and they go out there and kill people and whatnot. But I think when you look at the foundation of the show, the concept of the show, remember when it started? For the most part, these were all actors that weren't household names. Now, obviously, they became household names because of it, but there were only a couple of people, you know, in the regular cast that, you know, most entertainment buffs even knew who they were. So I think on that surface alone, it was kind of branded as this, you know, starting out as kind of like an underdog type show. And obviously, it gained some momentum. The content was incredible. People picked up on it. Word of mouth spread. And then it just developed into this juggernaut over time. And, you know, obviously, it became this iconic part of what pop culture has been in the United States and the world, really, for the last two decades. And who would have thought, right, back 20 years ago when a show like that started, that we would still be talking about it two decades later and really laying the foundation for all the ensuing television programs and specifically dramas that really I think were born because of The Sopranos. I mean, I don't know how you feel, but I mean, if you think about all the outstanding dramas that have been on in the last 20 years, you know, you want to go Breaking Bad, you know, you could go like The Homelands and on and on and on and on. I mean, there's several of them, you know, The House of Cards now has morphed over into Netflix and everything I think can be traced back to The Sopranos because that show gave people the forum, gave you the outlet to see, you know what, we could stretch storytelling. We could develop these characters in a way that maybe you were restricted to do so on network television in the confines of maybe a half an hour, 60 minutes with commercials, for example.
Yeah, totally agree. You know, it is pretty crazy to think it's been 20 years. I think you kind of see it when you rewatch the first season, like how young Gandolfini looks compared to like the later episodes, much thinner, has hair. And yeah, and I think he was Tony Soprano was really the first anti-hero on TV. We had it in movies that people really rooted for, despite the fact that he was really doing a lot of horrible right. things. You just absolutely catch yourself rooting for him. So they just finished the marathon on HBO. You know, I rewatched some episodes before we started recording. We were talking a little bit about that. What are some of your favorite episodes during the all the seasons that we've seen of Sopranos?
That isn't that a hard question? I mean, it's almost like, for example, I'm a huge Beatles fan, and it's like asking yourself, you know, what's your favorite Beatles songs? I could sit here and you know, just rattle off 50 off the top of my head because, you know, there's so much great material. For example, I'm always a little partial to, you know, when you start with season one, because season one was the foundation, as we keep talking about. You know, obviously the college episode was one that was critically acclaimed. And, you know, I remember seeing an interview that David Chase did once, you know, it might have been on one of the DVDs for season one and the bonus episodes and whatnot, and talking about college. And he almost fashioned that as that episode can almost be developed into a singular movie plot. You know, like you can have an entire movie off of that one episode where you almost just have dual storylines, you know, almost playing off of one another. And it allowed you to stretch out this story and it didn't feel like it was rushed or forced. And it was just played out so brilliantly like that over the course of an entire episode. I mean, that was phenomenal. Obviously, the Pine Barrens episode was tremendous. You know, you go on and on down the list. It's hard to just zero in on a couple. And that's why, as you were talking about, Dave, with the marathon, you know, the marathon that HBO, they did over the course of the last week, you put it on at any given time. And this was going up against NFL playoff games last weekend. And I found myself flipping over and getting caught on The Sopranos for like hours at a time. And I'm saying, well, wait a sec, there's playoff games on. I should. That's how addicting the material is, right? And I mean, we'd all fall into this trap. And then throughout the week, I'm sitting home at night and me and my wife were watching and we just get sucked in. And then before you know it, it's 3-4 episodes down. And where did the night go?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. The college one, as you said, could have been a movie. You mentioned Pine Barrens. I mean, that could easily be a movie. Like you could jump in, know nothing about the character, stretch it out, make it a movie. One of my favorites that I rewatched was Stage 5. And that's the one where Johnny Sack is like dying of cancer. And Phil at the end, that's when he really turns on Tony. And like the use of the music to me in the show is really one of the most underrated aspects of it.
Absolutely.
In my opinion.
Absolutely. Yep. You hit it right on the head. And I was going to get to that, too. The way the music was interjected throughout this year, way back in the beginning, nothing short of phenomenal. And that, I think, also adds another context and layer to the genius and the brilliance of the show. And the one that stands out to me, and we watched this episode again last week, is during the marathon one night. It was the season finale for season 5. It was an episode called All Due Respect. And it was the one where, you know, with Tony B up at the farm and, you know, he meets his demise there. And, you know, the episode ends where, you know, Tony goes to visit Johnny Sack or whatever. And then that's when Johnny's house is raided by the feds. They get John and Tony escapes or whatever. And he's running through the woods there in the snow. But the song that ends the episode, it's called Glad Tidings by Van Morrison. And I remember when that episode aired. So that was season 5. That was sometime, 2004, somewhere around there. And I you know, I love classic rock and I'm a Van Morrison fan or whatever. But that song was an album cut. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a hit single. And I wasn't familiar with that song. And I remember, and the beautiful part about like the way Chase uses the music in these episodes, like that one, for example, that song plays 3 times throughout the episode. It's interspersed a couple of times earlier, like with Christopher in the parking lot at the car. And then again at the end, and it's just brilliant. And you're like, oh my gosh, like what a phenomenal piece of music. How did I not know this? And yet here it is. And it adds a perfect context. We'll send you Glad Tidings from New York, when he's dealing with the mob boss of New York. It's brilliant. And then do you know what else I realized in that episode, Dave, for the first time? And I'd seen it many times, but I had just picked up on this the other night when I was watching it. If you remember when Tony's making his way back to his house there at the end, he stops off and he sits on the steps of a school. And in the school, you hear from the outside, it's like a children's choir classroom or whatever, and they're singing a song. And I never really paid attention to the music. They're singing Mr. Tambourine Man, the Bob Dylan song. The Birds did a version of it, of course, which is a little bit more popular. But you have a grammar school class singing Mr. Tambourine Man. It's phenomenal, just these little things that are interspersed throughout the show. And obviously, the theme song, which was just, you know, a track that some group did or whatever, and it became a cultural phenomenon.
Absolutely. So note to self, I'm going to have you back on later on just to talk about music because you are an aficionado. So for every, great character, and look, Tony is an anti-hero, but we all root for him, watches the show. He had a lot of pretty amazing antagonists and opponents. You know, in the first season, it was his mother, and really David Chase originally was really making a movie, a series about his relationship with his mother. We had Richie, we had Phil, we had some other ones. So which was, in your opinion, his toughest opponent or your favorite one out of the lot?
I think toughest one, and not to get too immersed in the psychology of everything, but obviously the toughest one was his mother, right? Because that's what kind of triggered all this off. And that was the thing that set off all these panic attacks and would send him to the psychiatrist's office, which really was the foundation of the entire series. As Jay said many times, it's not a mob show, right? It's a show about a man and his family. Now, obviously, he has two sets of families here, but one of the things that, and he gets some of that conflict with both his work family and his family. And I think it all stems from the mother, and you see that play itself out, not just in the first few seasons when she's alive and part of the show, but you see the residual effects from that, I think, from that time on. And, look, like you said, there's several, right? I mean, there's plenty of antagonists that he has to deal with in many ways, shapes, or forms. But I think everything starts at home, as they say. And not to get too deep into the Freudian aspect of it, but I think that that's probably where you got to start, no?
Yeah, I agree. And, to me, it's really remarkable how great the show was after the actress that played Livia died. And it's really amazing how they still were able to make the best TV show ever, despite that.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, not as a foe, it could be someone in Tony's crew, a side character, maybe not even a mobster. Who was your favorite character? I mean, Tony's a given. I think anyone would pick that. So who's your favorite other than Tony?
Boy, that's hard. I thought Richie Aprile was a piece of work in season two. I just got a kick out of him because here you had this guy, he just got out of the can and, the members only jackets and everything. And that whole storyline with the jacket that, he ended up giving Tony and Tony gives away to the housekeeper's husband or whatever. And that sets him off so much and just, he, I thought, was a tremendous character, even though he was around for just 1 year. But it's hard to narrow it down to just one. I mean, Uncle June, when he was with it, I thought had some great lines. I thought that the Junior and the Bobby Bacala dynamic between those two, like when he was his handler and, taking care of him and whatnot and shuttling him around, I thought there were some brilliant lines between those two and some real just like laugh out loud moments, like when he's under the house arrest in season two and he's looking for the tray of Monogut and Bobby comes over and turns out Bobby ate the whole darn thing and he flips out. That's laugh out loud funny stuff.
Yeah, no, it's really amazing. Like, to me, Sopranos could easily play as just a comedy, not even a mob series. That's how versatile it is. So we could talk forever about this, and maybe we'll do another episode down the road more on Sopranos. But I also want to talk about
you know, sports, because obviously you cover sports and the tri-state area and a lot of platforms. So when you and I first, you know, did a show together, we were talking about the World Cup. So I'm interested in asking, in your opinion, how do you see soccer? And since I'm talking to someone based in the U.S., I'm going to call him that. Tell me, how do you think this fits into the landscape of sports in the United States right at this moment?
I think that it has its place, obviously. And it's the look, we know, you and I know, everybody knows it's the most popular sport in the world, but it's not the most popular sport here in the United States. But I think that here in the U.S., it's probably fair to categorize it, David, as a niche sport, right? That I think that you have its fans, it has its base, you know, its core audience. And then on occasion, you'll have some people kind of jump on the bandwagon, pay attention when you have juicy storylines. And what I mean by that is obviously the World Cup. Like, you know, when you came on my show over the summer, normally on, you know, Mad Dog Radio, for example, we're not going to talk soccer throughout the year, but when the World Cup rolls around, a big tournament like that, we're going to pay it some attention. You know, obviously when the European Championships are held every 4 years, I'm always going to give that a nod or two, maybe not necessarily do lengthy spots on it, you know, on the national radio program in the U.S., but it has my attention. You know, the Copa America, things like that, Champions League. We're keeping an eye, or at least I'm keeping an eye on that stuff. And as far as my background is concerned with the sport, I grew up playing soccer. You know, so I've loved it since I was a boy. I played all the way through high school. But obviously, you know, growing up here, getting involved in sports here, the professional sports here in the United States are always going to take priority. And that's where most of my attention, you know, was focused and whatnot. But I certainly am a fan of the game, appreciate the game. And as you know, when you do have big tournaments and stuff like that going on, you cover it and you acknowledge it. And the question that I had about this past summer's World Cup is that how excited was the United States going to be for it, considering the U.S. didn't even qualify for the World Cup, which was a disaster in and of itself. But so maybe the enthusiasm was diminished a little bit there, but I still think all in all, it got enough attention to where it got people watching, and the folks still paid attention, I think, that wanted to just be captivated by some good sporting event, which of course it is.
Yeah. So let me ask you, in my opinion, I think soccer has a couple of things really going for it, especially in the U.S. I think, you know, the attention spans of people isn't what it used to be. We see some sporting events have a ton of commercial breaks. I think one thing that really helps soccer is 2 hours. You're in, you're out. You know when it's going to start, you know when it's going to end. There's really no commercials except for halftime. So in your opinion, when you look at the four big sports in the U.S., and that's American football, basketball, hockey, and baseball, is there one of them that you think is more vulnerable where, as you said, soccer is a niche sport and it's trying to get out of that? Do you think there's one of them that's vulnerable that maybe soccer can get into that fourth slot?
That's a tough question. And right now I'd probably be inclined to say I don't think so, because I think that they're pretty much well established. And look, even though hockey is considered one of the main sports, it's a considerable fourth from the other three. You know what I mean? Like it's still hockey. It's a professional sport, blah, blah, blah. But the enthusiasm, the attention that hockey gets here in the United States. Now, Canada's a different story, as we know, because Canada is number one, and that, they're going to talk about that 365 days a year. Hockey here, unfortunately, most people only pay the playoffs roll around, you know, and you get down to the nitty-gritty. I think that the NFL, the NBA, they're pretty solid 1-2. And the NBA, over the last 20 years, has leapfrogged Major League Baseball to move into that number two category. And I think it's on the strength of the personalities, the superstars, the individuals, you know, and basketball, there's so much drama involved with all these, you know, off the court stories and who's tweeting at who and Instagram and all the drama, which is, I think, leading to some of its popularity. And I think the NBA embraces that because it's more attention for their sport. And years ago, you know, probably, you know, before I was even born, but, you know, the 50s, the 60s, and into the 70s there, before the NFL really got its legs and developed and grew, there's no coincidence that baseball is referred to as the national pastime, because that was the number one sport, but that was a long time ago. And while they still generate record revenue on an annual basis in terms of what they bring in every year, the popularity is diminishing, David, because you talk to young, you talk to young people, or anytime you, you know, you interact with young people, NFL is popular to them. The NBA is popular to them. They know the personalities. But the enthusiasm for baseball is not what it was, let's say, when I was a kid. It's not. And you know what? Soccer is one of the things that's trumping that. Most, I'm telling you, there are a lot of young kids in this country now who are more inclined to know some of these soccer players who are playing overseas more so than baseball players who are playing right here in their backyard in the United States, which I think just speaks to how, you know, like the old saying, it's a small world, and how we're all just connected, you know, with social media, with the internet, and you're able to just, you know, be that close to something, even though it's considerably far away from you. So I think that that's one of the byproducts of technology and what that's been able to afford a lot of us here.
Yeah, I'm, you know, you would know this better than me, but I have a feeling if either Messi or Ronaldo walked down Fifth Avenue, they'd be more recognizable than whoever the biggest baseball player is now. I mean, I think Jeter and A-Rod, when they were playing, would have been an exception, but I think now that would be the other way around. It's definitely
If Messi or Ronaldo, to your point, if they were like walking down the street in New York, Times Square, whatever, they would be mobbed. Like if they were walking down one side of the street and on the other side of the street, Mike Trout was walking down, you know, and he's, you know, considerably the best player in baseball. More people are flocking to Messi and Ronaldo, no doubt.
Okay. So let me, I think this might be not your favorite subject. I'm going to bring it up. You obviously cover the New York teams a lot, and, you know, I'm based in Boston and we've had a resurgence, but my roots are my U.S. roots. I grew up in Italy, but I have family on Long Island. So for the most part, I support New York teams, but it's been a rough stretch recently. So I have to ask you of the, and I think for you, you know, covering it, it has to be pretty hard, especially the NFL. It's been a really rough stretch with that. So let me ask you, of the top New York teams in any sport, which one do you think is the closest to winning a title, and which one is the most hopeless right now?
Unfortunately, I mean, it sounds like a broken record. It's probably the same answer you'd be able to give for the last 20 years, because I didn't grow up a fan of this team. But you got to say the Yankees. You know, they're the closest to winning a championship. The only problem that they face right now is that they play in the same division as the champion in Major League Baseball. So it's one thing to be really good, which the Yankees were, right? They won 100 games last year, but yet they still couldn't even say they won their division because you had the Red Sox who won a few games more and then beat them in the playoffs. So they're trying to narrow that gap. And I think that they've done some nice things this offseason to maybe do so, but I still think the Red Sox are one peg ahead of the Yankees, especially if they finally re-sign Craig Kimbrell and get him back in the bullpen there. So Yankees, I would say, is probably the closest to winning a championship. As far as the most hopeless right now or the furthest away, it's a tough question. I would probably say, believe it or not, I'll probably maybe the Rangers or the New York Knicks. I would probably say the reason I'll say not so much Knicks, or the Knicks maybe have a little bit better chance, only because you know how things are with basketball. If you get one guy, one difference maker, I mean, not I use his name, but LeBron James, he's not coming here. But if you put that guy on your team, or a player of his ilk, Kevin Durant, whatever, that could change the fortunes of your club overnight like that in basketball, because it's only five guys on the court. One guy makes that big of a difference. The other sports, it takes a little bit more. Football, certainly. Baseball, same thing even with hockey. You need a few of those guys. But one guy can get you on your way here with basketball. If the Knicks get themselves, you know, the top pick in the draft, and they draft Zion Williamson or whatever from Duke, who looks like he could be a future superstar, maybe that becomes someone that could change the tide for them.
Yeah, and look, the Knicks are, as bad as they've been, still a glamour franchise. Madison Square Garden is the mecca basketball, to some players, you know, legacy is important. And I think there's no better legacy than if you can get the Knicks to win the title. I think if a player really wanted to elevate his position historically, it's kind of hard to imagine something better than making that happen. So let's get into your career, because I'm fascinated by this. I think anyone that's been listening to the podcast so far, obviously, here's your chops. You could cover a lot of subjects. Like, you have a lot of versatility, you know, music, pop culture, but you can talk about a lot of different sports. So I have to ask you, how did you get into this field? Like, for those that listeners that aren't that familiar, like, Dan works on some really huge platforms here in the U.S. So how did you know you wanted to do this, and how did you get started?
Well, how did I know is probably the easier one, only because just growing up as a kid, you know, huge sports fan. You know, I was reading the sports page when I was in kindergarten. That's a true story, you know. So it was just something that I guess my dad, you know, exposed me to it early. And it was just something, even at that ripe old age, I was able to just pick up on it, and I was drawn to it. And I can't explain it. You know, I was 5 years old, but it was just something that continued to grow and something I never really lost all throughout my life. And, you know, in college, they always tell you, and look, you even get this from people close to you. Oh, well, that's great. You know, but you can't make a career out of this, or you can't, you know how hard it is to break into that, and not everybody makes it, and you have to have a fallback plan, you know, and they just want your best interest. They're looking out for you and everything. So when I went to college, you know, I originally went into school to do business because that was a little safer than going the sports broadcasting route, because it was a much more difficult field to break into. But I just wasn't happy doing the other curriculum. And, you know, I wasn't necessarily giving it my best effort because I was still preoccupied with the sports and doing that other stuff. And then it got to a point where I said, you know what, I'm just going in, I'm doing this, I'm jumping in with both feet. And, you know, that's what I did. But the one thing that I always tell people too, it's, if you want to do this, it's not something that you're going to learn in a classroom. It's not something you could sit there and a professor's going to tell you, you know, you write down the notes that he puts up on the chalkboard, or you're going to read out of a book. You got to go out there and do it. You got to go out there and put in the reps yourself. And, you know, people ask, well, what's the advice to get started and whatnot? And I'll tell you, David, the most important thing that happened to me when I was in school, and the thing that I take from school more than anything else, was my last semester, I got an internship. And that opened up the doors. Like, this whole business, it's about who you know. It's about the connections you make. And I got an internship with ESPN Radio in New York. And it wasn't even on the production or the broadcasting side. It was in the promotions department, which couldn't be further from on air. I would show up to different events that they had, whether it was games or whatnot, and, you know, hand out magnets and hand out bumper stickers and T-shirts and flyers and whatnot. You know, but I was involved in the radio station in some way. I at least had an in. I got to step foot in the studio to see what it was like. And then you meet people and you express to them, yeah, I'd like to do this one day. And I'll never forget that semester when I was still interning, they had an opening and a need for somebody to work the phones on Thanksgiving morning. And I jumped at the opportunity. And that was my first exposure to the studio. And I got to answer phones for whatever show was on Thanksgiving morning. And to me, it was the thrill of a lifetime. But, you know, from that, I got hired as a part-time, like, assistant producer, doing, like, all the behind-the-scenes work and so on and so forth. But I was meeting people. You know, I continued to have their ear and let them know that I wanted to do this on air. And then just, you know, eventually opportunities presented themselves and continued to make connections and network and so on and so forth. And all these years later, one thing led to another, and here I am.
Very, very interesting. I can relate to a lot of it. And this actually sounds a lot like the career of the producer of my podcast, who is now becoming like a star with his own content. So great stuff. So I have two more questions for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, cover sports. Do you consider yourself the more of like a journalist or more of an entertainer, analyst? Like, if someone asks you, what do you do for a living? How do you describe yourself?
That's a great question. That really is. And I guess the best way to answer that is depending what I'm – the answer is it depends on what I'm doing on that given day, right? Because, you know, and I'm so fortunate to have these wonderful gigs and to do different things. If I'm doing a talk show, I'm entertaining, right? You want to keep people engaged as long as possible. You want to keep people tuned in. If I'm, you know, reporting from a game, like tomorrow, for example, I, you know, do pre and post for the Knicks on the radio. I have a Knicks game. It's pretty straightforward. We're talking about the game, giving information about the game. We're recapping the game. So you're not doing as much entertaining necessarily. So, but more often than not, I would probably say, yeah, more entertaining, I think, than the two. At least you try to be, right? You hope you can be. Because at the end of the day, this is fun, what we're talking about. You know, none of this stuff is real life. You know, life or death matters. I know people take it seriously, and then it's very important. And look, everybody loves their sports, and we all can relate to that. But at the end of the day, it's still fun. It's hobby. It's leisure. So you want to at least make it as fun as possible, even if your teams don't necessarily do what you want them to do.
Yeah, and you know, I've learned that the passion and the fact that people see it as life or death is a good thing, because thank God it gives opportunities for people like you and I to do it. And sometimes you're at the other end, like people are really passionate and they might give you, you know, some attitude because of your opinion. But then I always say, thank God they feel so strongly, because if not, they wouldn't be consuming my content to begin with. So you've shared a lot of great tips. So, you know, you took a gig on Thanksgiving morning. You started at the bottom. You made connections. And look, you know, I did a few shows with you, and I put in the back of my mind, I was like, hey, someday I'm going to have him on my show. And, you know, you wear a lot of different hats. I think your versatility is definitely really, really important. Is there any other advice that you would give to someone that's listening now that wants to follow in your footsteps, Dan?
Pretty much just, you know, building on what I said, you know, don't turn down any opportunity, you know, do as much as you possibly can. Take on every job as if that's the dream job that you set out to do from day one, because you never know what doors are going to open. You never know. You know, things present themselves in a very funny way, really in all walks of life, but specifically in this business. And you know, meet as many people as you can, get involved with as many things as you can do, make yourself as versatile as possible, and you never know what doors are going to open for you. And just be prepared to work hard. You know, that's the one thing that's not going to be compromised is hard work. You put in the time, you put in the preparation, and generally good things are going to happen. And the other thing, too, I'll say this, you know, don't expect this to be your normal Monday through Friday 9-to-5 job. It is not in any way, shape, or form. Okay, say goodbye. Say goodbye to weekends. Say goodbye to holidays in some cases, because in this business, there's no such thing as weekends. There's no such thing as weekdays. You know what? They don't cancel games on weekends. They don't cancel games on holidays. There's stuff to do, you know? So if you work for a team, or, you know, I do, you know, I just finished my first season as the pre and post game host for the Jets. Had a phenomenal time. But look, if the Jets had to play a game on Thanksgiving, I don't tell them, nah, you know what, I'm not working today because it's Thanksgiving. No, you're working. That's, you know, when we watch games on holidays, all the guys who are playing in the game, who are announcing the games or whatnot, yeah, I'm sure they'd love to be home with their families and doing, you know, just normal stuff. But no, they got to work. And this business, a lot of it is the same.
Wow, Dan, I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much. Not just the Soprano talk. I think a lot of people get a lot out of this. So I want to thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to doing, you know, other shows with you, hopefully on your platform. And you're always welcome back here to talk about music, TV, sports. If you have the itch to talk about soccer, you know where to find me. So thank you so much for doing this.
Dave, always a pleasure, my friend. It was a blast, and best to all your listeners out there as well. And you know where to find me, my friend. Let's do it again soon.